today on Agents of Cool, we cover the fourth and to date final Daniel Craig James Bond movie, Spectre. What is our opinion of it? Where could the film series possibly go from here? Stay tuned for our seriously spoilerific podcast. Welcome to today's episode of Agents of Cool, where we conclude our analysis of the Daniel Craig sequence of James Bond films with the most recent release, 2015's Spectre. This is Eric, Grumpy Number 6, as always, joined by...
Ray.
And...
Stacy.
So we actually did a very brief podcast from in front of the theater the day we saw Spectre back in 2015, and we were all trippy over the moon excited about it. I haven't actually watched it since until I watched it last night in preparation for the show today. And I gotta say, I love the hell out of that movie. Yep. I genuinely love the hell out of that movie.
It still holds up.
You know, I imagine if we wanted to really dig in. Well, that's it. There you go. Stacey, what do you think?
Something in my head was down on it, but watching it, almost everything was really awesome.
There you go. That's the show, ladies and gentlemen. Thumbs up all around. Join us next week for... No, wait, kidding.
This episode should at least be longer than the microdot.
Probably should. All right, so 2015, there are some parameters for the discussion we should probably lay out first. I mean, how is it as a movie? How is it as a Bond film? And how well does the film accomplish its goals, to wit, making the Dan... And this is a retcon, and they admitted that going in, but can you then... The film implies that the plots of Casino and Quantum and Skyfall are all linked in ways that the films weren't when they were actually being made. Can you go back and look at those films now from the point of view of Spectre, and does it make sense? Does it hold water?
The other thing to look at, this was covered briefly, but the other big piece is this does represent a big, giant, historic moment in the history of James Bond films in that...
Blofeld and Spectre are back.
Yeah, you have everything back under one roof again.
And now, if you want details about that, go look back on our show listings. We actually did a whole big show about the historical significance of Spectre coming back and all the legal machinations and everything else. We're not going to recap any of that here today because we did, what, a good 2 hours on that? We did a good 2 hours on that.
You know, it's worth mentioning. This is...
It's a landmark.
Yeah, this is kind of huge for Bond history. The sky's the limit. They can do anything they want now going forward.
Yeah.
Now, they also have the problem, I guess we'll get to when we get to the end of the movie, is how do they go forward from here? But that's a discussion for a little bit later in the show.
We'll get there, though. I've got some serious reservations about that, too. So the film opens, the opening gun sight.
Is unnamed... that the first time they've done that for the Craig movies?
I think so, except maybe Casino.
I don't think they did it in Casino either.
Well, this is the first time a Dan Craig Bond movie has opened with a proper gun sight opening. And we roll into a title. Mm-hmm. This is unusual. It says, "The Dead Are Alive." Now, mm-hmm. What could that mean? Could that mean there are lots of ways you could read that? You could read that as saying the past is always with us, that you can't escape your past. It could mean literally that people you thought were gone are reaching back out at you, literally, metaphorically. And then we cut to the Mexican Day of the Dead, Mexico City, which is nicely evocative of other festivals we've seen in Bond films. It's reminiscent of the Junkaroo from Thunderball. It's a little bit like Roger at Mardi Gras in Moonraker. We've seen Bond in festival circumstances before, and the opening sequence here is, it's a unbelievable ongoing continuing shot.
Yeah, did they do that all in one take? There's one bit where it like dwells on the Day of the Dead sign where I thought they might have worked in a cut, but I can't...
I think they may have cheated it a little bit here and there, but a lot of it's... I think they did a lot of that live.
So when we were watching that, and I'm still kind of floored by watching again, just... It keeps going and going and going and going.
Now, of course, the classic, I mean, I think the first real serious ongoing tracking shot like that would be Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, right? Which I think, were we all in the same film class? Did we all watch that together?
I was not in that film class.
Did we watch that together? We watched that together, yeah. And you're going into the crowd and there's a figure in a white suit coming at you. He stands up, the crowd's all in like dark clothes and blacks and grays and things. And there's a figure in a white tuxedo with a death mask coming at you. And you pass him by.
Yeah, it looks like you're going to follow him for a minute, and then he's not the one.
But then someone else comes in.
Mm-hmm.
A man in a black suit with a skeleton on it and a white skull's mask and a top hat. And of course, we're quoting Bond films here in the beginning, so it reminds you a little bit of Jeffrey Holder in Live and Let Die, right?
It's Baron Samedi.
Baron Samedi, but with the skeleton motif and whatnot. And then when you follow this guy, and then you probably, if you've got any brains at all, you figured out, oh, this is Bond.
Well, and, I mean, as soon as you see those eyes.
Yeah, the eyes and the bristle-cut hair and everything else.
Strangely, and maybe it's because he literally has a pelvis drawn onto his outfit, but for once, the camera seemed to be dwelling on his butt instead of the ladies.
Oh,
there you go.
Yeah, the skeleton on the tails of the tuxedo coat, yeah, it looked like he was kind of sashaying up the stairs at the hotel.
And well, because Bond fans, there are female Bond fans who happen to like Mr. Craig. Man candy for them, too.
To go back to the ladies' hotel room.
One thing before you go on, he is garbed as a figure of death.
Right.
In this film, and incidentally, this film, more than any other of the Craig films, I think emphasizes him as assassin, as bringer of death. That's and he true. Is garbed in the opening as an image of death, the Reaper himself.
Right. And then he gets to the ladies' hotel room. There looks like they're getting ready to do what you normally do in the ladies' hotel room. And she looks over after crawling onto the bed seductively, and he has stripped down to his regular suit. And is heading out onto the ledge.
With a gun.
Says he'll be back in a minute with a gun. Crosses over several of the rooftops of Mexico City and is apparently here to snipe somebody.
Mm-hmm. He's eavesdropping on that guy in the white suit we saw in the opening shot. The guy's name is Marco Sciarra. And he's apparently involved in planning a terrorist explosion at a sports arena, at a stadium later. Mm-hmm.
And something about paying a visit to the Pale King.
Exactly. So then the people Bond is observing, he's got some kind of, is the gun one of those things where he can pick up sound with the laser off the window?
I think the impression is that little light blue laser is being used to pick up sound from the room by reading the
Which
vibrations of the glass.
Which is a little bit better than the visible laser dot thing, I guess, for noticing the sniper.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yet the same basic thing happens because
right. So he need a complication. They notice him, he proceeds to still shoot everyone but Sciarra. And somehow blow up the building.
I think he hits the bomb.
So the first person who notices him and opens fire, Bond shoots him. Mm-hmm. Sciarra runs, and then Bond's trying to shoot up the window. Did he deliberately or accidentally shoot the bomb? I think he accidentally shot the bomb.
I think that was accidental.
I'm pretty sure, too.
Because then the whole building starts to fall down.
Explodes, and then he's running from a falling building, and then...
Which crushes the roof that he's on and causes him to fall some distance.
So right now, we're not even 5 minutes into this movie, and they've already spent more than most movies. You've already got sex and death and explosions and guns and violence and bombs, and we're not even 5 minutes in.
And lots and lots and lots of extras.
Lots and lots and lots of extras. This is an expensive-ass movie, and God bless them for it.
I hope they got it in one take.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out if they recreated a Day of the Dead parade or just went to one. I guess if they had all that other stuff, they would have had to just have all those extras. I think they would have to
recreate, because otherwise, if you're not controlling it, you're going to get people wondering what's up with the camera crew and everything and waving at the camera and such. Mm. And now I don't know how much of that was, and that's the thing, I don't know how much of that the crowd scenes were digital, how much of them were, you know, some live crowds and then digital multiplication.
And see, that's the beautiful thing about Bond. They're the best there is at maintaining the illusion.
I was really, when he was walking over the building, I couldn't tell, is he actually walking over the buildings or is that a digital effect? I think the building collapsing and falling on, I think that was a digital effect, but
it was very, I mean, all the stuff falling and then the roof that he's on falling was very... There were a lot of rocks and dust and stuff that made it look very real.
Oh, it was very little. The only reason I'm thinking it was a digital effect is I just can't see them
knocking down a building.
Putting your principal in that much.
Right.
Well, like I said, they're very good at maintaining the illusion. Chris Corbold, I think you say his name, one of the best in the business, one of the best that ever was at those large scale physical effects like that. He's the guy that rotated the hotel rooms in Inception, for example. Mm-hmm. Chris Corbold, and he always does like the big physical effects for Bond movies like this. It could have been a set rig to fall over. It could have been intercutting a miniature. It could have been a combination of sets, miniature, and digital. And then some shots are a stuntman, some shots are your lead. They're very good at maintaining illusion, which is one of the things I love about Bond movies. You can kind of, you don't have to worry about being taken out of the experience while you're having it.
And what I thought was maybe a bit of a Roger Moore era touch, Bond ultimately, he does a little bit of parkouring his way down, but then he ultimately just lands on a comfy couch at the bottom.
There was one thing about this. I think there were a lot of moments, I don't know if it was intentional or just because there's been a lot of James Bond movies. Mm-hmm. This was the
24th.
Wow.
So there seemed to be lots of little moments that reminded me of other little moments in other James Bond movies throughout this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's such a large body of text to draw on at this point, both in terms of books and movies. There are also a couple of little shout outs to good old Uncle Ian in the course of the film, which I really, really like too. Some stories that you just can't work in anything else but a name. But we're finally getting that name spoken aloud in a Bond film, for example. But we'll get to that later, too.
Right. Okay. So he gets up, notices that Sciarra has nonetheless managed to survive alive, despite him bringing the entire building down. Sciarra spots him and runs. They chase through the parade. Sciarra calls for a helicopter to pick him up in the square.
And then Bond grabs a walking stick from a passerby, smacks a, I don't want to say a Spectre guy in the head yet, smacks a henchman in the head with it, jumps in the helicopter, and then you've got Bond trying to beat the crap out of Sciarra in a helicopter, careening through the skies over Mexico City during the Day of the Dead celebration.
Because every once in a while, somebody stops to slam the pilot's head into something, so the helicopter does not remain stable.
Because that's what you want to do, is smack the pilot's head around.
So, yeah.
Which, if you're James Bond, apparently that is what you want to do. It did work out well in the end for him. I don't know.
The helicopter is basically facing in every possible direction over the course of this. It goes straight up. It goes upside down for a while. I think Bond even takes advantage of the fact that it's going to change position at one point so that he can fall back onto Sciarra.
And then eventually everybody in the helicopter but Bond ends up exiting the helicopter in midair.
And then Bond gets hold of the ring that Sciarra is wearing.
Which has what on it?
An octopus.
Dun, dun, dun.
And thus we go into the most tentacly James Bond opening sequence
The most
ever.
Tentacled opening sequence. Oh, I do think we should name check how satisfied Bond looks as he flies away in the helicopter. The sun's setting. He's got a brand new helicopter to fly around in. He's alive. The other guys aren't. It's a good day at work. But then we find out after the title sequence that it's not actually a day at work
at all.
That was not work.
He was there to murder this guy, and it was not an assignment that M gave him.
Let's go back to that credit sequence, though.
Mm-hmm. Very tentacly.
Yeah, but I mean, it was very much in line with a lot of your other ones, but not. I mean, just having coming on the heels of just watch For Your Eyes Only recently, which is one of your classic ones, it was kind of evoking the classic ones, and then the octopus shows up. It was weird, and all the skull and eye motifs.
Oh, there were
throughout.
A lot of eyeballs as well. That's
yeah.
True.
Just
eyeballs.
The staring.
We're watching.
Yeah, the staring eyes, or the one where it's just like hundreds of eyeballs on the screen at once was just, that was a weird opening.
Ever since Pierce came back in 95, the openings have been kind of weird.
No, but this was weird and menacing. I mean, then you've got the music, the song that goes with it, where it's just like, you go into this wondering, you know, this is obviously been building this up, and of course the trailers and such, that, you know, this is James Bond going up against something so big, maybe even he can't stop it.
Yeah.
And the opening credits pretty much just hammer that home with all the subtlety of, well, an exploding octopus made of fire. So.
Yeah. Well, we don't go to Bond films for subtlety.
No, but I mean, even, like I said, this one is just like, you know, you show somebody that who's never seen a James Bond movie with those lyrics, you just want, this very much has Swan Song written, ba-dum-tish, written all over it.
Very good. Oh, that's good. Do you think that was on purpose?
I don't know, but... You know.
Swan Song? That's good. I like that.
So yeah, we get to M's office, and it turns out this was not an assignment.
And Voldemort's pissed.
Yes, Voldemort's because really... Because Bond killed at least two guys, and blew up a building.
Killed some guys, blew up a building, all unauthorized. And he's not... And
he won't tell M why.
He won't even confirm with M
says
that
he
did it.
He was on vacation.
I was just on vacation in Mexico, taking some holiday in Mexico City. Was all
and
I was doing.
M's apparently under a lot of stress anyway, because there's a proposed merger of MI6 with MI5, mm-hmm. and they're wanting to shut down the 00 program.
And the guy that runs MI5 is named Max Moriarty Denby. I'm sorry, it's Moriarty from Sherlock. The minute he walks in, you don't trust him. You can't possibly trust him. He's freaking Moriarty.
He's slimy.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, he just does slimy and not trustworthy at very, very well. I mean, that's, you kind of wonder, are they doing a double bluff? Kind of like in Hunger Games?
You know how, like, Sean Bean's presence in the movie constitutes a spoiler?
Yeah.
So does the presence of Moriarty. Well, if the guy that plays Moriarty is in your movie, his presence constitutes a spoiler about that character.
Well, but remember Hunger Games, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman as, you think he's the bad guy? And turns out
he's
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
No, I don't necessarily assume that about him.
And he's
him.
Being creepy.
He was the game designer, director, head dude in The Hunger Games. So he's basically Arcade, who set up this giant death trap. So you kind of assume that, yes, he's pretty much,
That's
you
a
know,
shame he's gone.
Yeah.
I loved him. He would have made a great Arcade. A little shout out for your X-Men people, yes. X-Men villain Arcade. Anyway.
No, I think the definitive one was Jesse Eisenberg in Batman versus Superman.
He would have made a great
fair.
Arcade,
that,
too.
No, he played a great Arcade.
It's not very much of a Luthor.
It wasn't really much of a Luthor performance. I'm not sure what happened with his pages from the script there, but yeah.
But
back to Bond.
Back to Bond, right, which so is ostensibly the show we're doing.
Right. So we meet this slimy guy, Max Denby. Bond calls him C, which of course is the actual real world name of the guy that the Bond books and movies call M.
Well, I thought C was the designant for the MI5 guy.
Nope, that's the MI6 guy.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, well. I think I'll call you C. And then they play around a little bit with what C may actually stand for. Because we're a family origin podcast, we're not going to go into that. But if you're familiar at all with derogatory English slang, you can probably put two and two together and come up with a really nasty four-letter word. Family show, guys. Mm-hmm. So then Bond's told to stand down, and he exits in a huff. He's mad at M. He's mad at C. C's mad at Bond. C's mad at M. M's mad at everybody because he's Voldemort. And then we go on, and then he's asking Moneypenny to come by his place later.
Right. Moneypenny approaches and says they've collected a bunch of what they could from the destruction of Skyfall, and it belongs to him, so she was going to give it to him. And he says to come to his place at 9 o'clock that night.
And she does. And he's there, and he's in his flat, which is maybe the second time we've ever seen Bond's flat.
Probably.
He was in Live and Let Die, and then it's in this one. And it's not terribly well furnished. He's got pictures he hasn't hung. There's a big TV. There's a couch. That's about it.
She asked if he just moved in, and no, apparently he has not just moved in.
Did you just move in?
That's just the
way it is. No? Oh, okay.
So Bond reveals to Moneypenny that he has final orders that were left for him from the last M. And she's the one that said, you need to go after this Sciara guy, kill him, and be sure to attend his funeral.
So it's a video clip that showed up in his email, Judy Dench, M, saying, all right, if you're seeing this, it means I'm dead. Find Marco Sciara, kill him, and go to the funeral. Okay.
So naturally he's doing that.
So naturally he goes and does that.
Right. He also asks Moneypenny, without letting M know, to look into this Pale King reference.
And Moneypenny, despite this being, because she's good and loyal and she's Moneypenny, she goes and she's going to do this thing, even though, you know, probably going to get her fired. And then we have some nice business with Q.
First of all, there's a bit of, when he gets the effect from Skyfall, he finds, partially burned, the Order of Guardianship for himself after his parents died, and a picture of himself with an adult man and an older boy whose head is burned off.
In the picture, I should point out.
Right. Because the picture is partially burned. But yes.
Not that the boy's head's actually been burned off.
Right.
The picture's been burned off, and because this is a Bond movie, we have to make the distinction.
Right. So yeah, the next day, Tanner and Bond are on a boat admiring the old MI6 building, which is about to be demolished, and the shiny new HQ that they built for C and his new joint security service. Q has apparently moved away from Whitehall and is keeping a lab underground.
Because he's tired of people being all up in his biz. It cracks me up that Q is also the voice of Paddington.
I did not notice
that. I didn't know that.
The Paddington movie that's been out, and there's going to be another one out, that's Q.
Oh, that's adorable.
So in one world, he's like the wonderful little bear who loves marmalade. In this other world, he's a nerd who figures out cool new ways to murder people. Murder bear. So there's Q injects him with smart blood.
Right. I think something like this has happened once before. Was it Casino Royale?
Casino Royale. There's like a tracking chip.
Right. This is apparently little nano transceivers in his blood that will tell Q where he is at all times. He also doesn't get the sweet DB10 car that he was going to be issued. That's going to 009 now because Bond has been suspended. He does get a watch that tells time.
Well, the budget cuts.
The watch not only tells time, but has a very loud alarm. This comes up later.
Oh, I think I know what you mean, Q.
He talks Q into giving him 48 hours during which the nanite blood will not be reliable.
By talk, you mean threatens.
Right.
Isn't every conversation Bond has tacitly threatening?
Some more than others. This was, I think, right. Well, then for the sake of the cats.
Oh, right.
I have a mortgage and two cats that have to be fed.
So, yes. He gives Bond first 24, and then Bond just sort of glares at him, and he ups it to 48 hours, might drop, and therefore Bond can go do what he needs to do. And Bond repays him for this by stealing the DB10.
Bond goes to Rome, goes to the funeral of Marco Sciara, where he finds Sciara's widow, who is, thank God, Monica Bellucci.
But wait. Right before he talks to Monica Bellucci.
What happens right before he talks to Monica Bellucci?
Everybody files out of the cathedral, and then they're presumably, I guess, at the interment at the mausoleum or whatnot. And Bond, is looking at the widow in the ceremony, and he attention keeps getting drawn to the back of somebody's head that's kind of in the crowd between him and Monica Bellucci.
Ah.
And he keeps cutting back, and he kind of cocks his head, and it's like, you never see the guy's face. You see him tilt his head slightly, so maybe he can see Bond in the reflection of his sunglasses. And then the service concludes, and he leaves, and then he goes to talk to Monica Bellucci. But
I did not notice that either.
You get the impression that, like, Bond... Do I recognize this? What's going on here? Because again,
are you suggesting that's...
Yeah, no, that is.
Oh,
that absolutely is.
Wow, he would actually go to the guy's funeral.
No, that's him. That's who else? I mean, again, he's not just in the crowd there. I mean, again, he kind of cocks his head.
Oh,
and
wow,
looks in
I
his
totally
sunglasses.
Missed that.
Yeah, I missed that too. I'll keep an eye out for that one the next time I watch it. So, but back to the important thing, right, Monica Bellucci.
Right. And Monica Bellucci is being followed around by these two guys who are apparently not so much her bodyguards as the people who have been sent to kill her now that her husband is dead because she knows too much.
She knows too much. So Bond follows her back to her villa, and she's dressed in black, and she's having a drink, and she looks like a woman who's maybe getting ready to die, because she's getting ready to die. And
The two gentlemen with guns following her out on the
Each hiding next
lawn.
To one doorway in the completely direct shot she has all the way out to her awesome swimming pool.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that two people are following her with the guns and aiming them at her head does imply that she is not long for this world.
Yes.
But turns out it's those two guys that aren't long for the world, because, and they're down. And it's Bond. And it's the scene where he's, like, getting information from the widow of the Spectre, getting information from Sciara's widow, because we don't know who he worked for yet.
Right.
That's a surprise. We don't know that yet. Sorry.
He seduces her pretty quickly. Apparently, her husband gave more time to this organization than he did to her. So she doesn't really miss him all that much.
And then Bond says, oh, he was more obsessed with the organization than you? What a fool. And I got to back that up. Monica Bellucci, people. All right.
And she explains that he's part of this very powerful organization that still has hundreds of more people to send to kill her. But they're going to be meeting at midnight tonight to select her husband's replacement.
Bond leaves a phone number for her. And it's not his number, for God's sake. He's not leaving his number. He leaves the number of his American friend, Felix.
I thought he had just got off the phone with... I was a little unclear on that point. Had he just gotten off the phone?
It looks like he wrote down a number. So. Okay.
Looked like he wrote down a phone number. Yeah. Leave it to Bond. He's not leaving anybody his phone number.
Well, no, he references an American friend.
Felix.
But, yeah, but I wasn't sure if he had just gotten off the phone with Felix or not.
I don't know. It could be both. But she asks if he's writing down his phone number. And she said, you know, because it was the end of their date or whatever. And she says...
Date?
Yeah.
Nah.
They're sexy
We use the word date loosely on this podcast.
They had sexy times.
Wow.
Fortunately, that music was not used. All right. So Bond goes to this meeting at the Palazzo de something. He uses the octopus ring to get in.
Goes to the Palazzo de Bad Guy.
Yes.
No, bad, but de Baggy. De Baggy? What's that thing from the Muppet sequel? Dominic de... Never mind. So he goes to the Palazzo del Evil.
Uses the octopus ring to get in, though someone still makes a phone call after he walks by. Mm-hmm. There's basically a board of directors, the classic setup, if we've seen this organization
Thunderball right. In particular, it's the scene where they're going over their ledger, basically.
Right.
It's reporting a business meeting.
Criminal enterprises, sex trafficking, and all.
Fake AIDS drugs in sub-Saharan Africa.
Female migrants in the leisure trade, I believe, is the way they put
it. That has got to be the best double talk I've ever heard. Female migrants in the leisure industry. In the leisure sector. Oh, boy.
Yeah, this is very clearly the board meeting of Evil Incorporated.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A completely shadowed leader that everyone is obviously either respectful or afraid of arrives and takes his seat at the head of the table and says, don't let me interrupt you. Go back.
Can I just say that this has got to be one of the most sinister scenes ever in a Bond film? All the incredible setting, the Palazzo with the marble and the columns and it's like the most extravagant surroundings you can imagine. The most plush, lush. I mean, the rich wood of the table and the art on the walls and everybody in their suits and evening clothes. And this is utter corruption. I mean, the highest level of decadence and corruption you can conceive of. And it's gorgeously filmed. Before I forget, the cinematography in this one, Skyfall and Spectre are both directed by Sam Mendes. Skyfall was shot by Roger Deakins. This one was shot by a guy named Hoyt, something I can't pronounce. Skyfall was shot digital, looked very different to this film. This film, the cinematography, while different, is just as exquisite. A lot of scenes are fairly monochromatic in that we're ranging from yellow to gold to shades of brown, or in some sequences, blacks, whites, silvers, grays. A lot of it's monochromatic, but it is just as lush and as rich as you could possibly... I mean, some of it looks like Renaissance paintings, for God's sake, particularly these scenes in the Palazzo. It's gorgeously, gorgeously filmed.
So they get to talking about the fact that Mr. Schiari is dead and he still had a duty left to perform, namely the elimination of this pale king. So they ask for volunteers. The guy at the foot of the table stands up and starts talking about how awesome he is and how he volunteers. Mm. And the shadowy leader apparently sets him up by making sure that someone asks, does anyone contest this position?
And someone does.
This large man, Dave Bautista, Drax from the Guardians of the Galaxy movies.
And he's huge.
Yes. Comes in and displays his credentials by killing the previous guy.
Specifically.
With his metal fingernails.
Specifically, he grabs the guy, crushes his eyes with metal thumbnails, slams him into the table and breaks his neck, and never says a word.
And then just takes his spot at the table.
His name is never actually called in the film. The character's name is Mr. Hinks.
Perfect James Bond.
Perfect villain name. And he's very well dressed. He delicately removes a hanky from inside his jacket, wipes the gore off his thumbs, sits down at the table. Like, oh, I'm sorry, I got the sauce on my hands. Let me daintily clean this up before I sit down and talk about some more murder.
And then, much to Bond's surprise, we presume, the leader greets him, welcomes him to the meeting.
Welcome,
James. Says
it's
been a long time, like they're old acquaintances, and he puts his face into the light so Bond can see it. We don't know who he is, except he's Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz, and we know who Christoph... Let's be honest. At this point, the movie's called Spectre. It's Christoph Waltz. We fucking know who it is. Pardon my French.
Well,
family show.
We
know who it is.
We 100% know who it is.
We know who it is.
Because then they add this whole other layer, which we can talk about later. But,
well, which actually is about to, about to come up because...
Right. Oh, and he says, cuckoo, for reasons we don't fully understand.
But will be explained later.
Yes. And then Bond escapes in a hail of gunfire. Gets into his fancy car and drives away. Hinks follows in. What kind of car was that, right?
That was a Jaguar he was following in. So we have an Aston Martin being chased by a Jaguar.
An Aston Martin DB10 being chased by like a really burnished orangey bronze Jaguar.
It was a prototype.
Gorgeous cars.
Pretty sweet car chase. Bond quickly discovers that because he stole the DB10, not all of the gadgets are ready.
The gadgets aren't ready yet.
The guns haven't been loaded. One of the other buttons just plays 009's favorite music.
Cracked me up. 009 apparently likes, what was it? Was it just like Dean Martin-y jazz or something? I don't
know. No, it was, I Did It My Way. It was Sinatra. Mm.
There you go.
There were four little switches with like Dymo labels on them that were clearly aftermarket. It was shown in a really, really close shot, so I'm not strictly sure, you know, Aston Martin really wanted them to staple stuff to the hand-sewn leather interior. But so there's like, backfire, atmosphere, exhaust, and air.
And air.
Which all happened to mean something. So yeah, backfire is the rear machine guns, but they haven't been loaded.
Similar to atmosphere's music. Similar to Generations all those years ago, where the photon torpedoes weren't going to be loaded till Tuesday.
Right.
Apparently, Q hadn't actually put the bullets in the car yet, and the atmosphere was, like you say,
just music.
Yeah, Desmond Llewellyn somewhere is like, we load up your playlist now. Desmond Llewellyn didn't load your damn playlist for you. You took care of your own damn playlist, Bond.
Okay. Also, Ray, you mentioned that possibly to hold everyone's interest, we find out more of what's going on from Moneypenny during the car chase.
Yeah, so, and this is kind of, this I thought was kind of clever, because, okay, you've got Bond, and then you've got Hinks in the Jaguar CX-75, which I think was
nice car.
Yeah, I like the Aston Martin better, but it's the Jag, it's not bad.
You wouldn't turn your nose up if somebody parked a Jaguar in your driveway either.
No, I wouldn't.
Although I heard they were in the shop a lot.
They have a reputation for being somewhat temperamental, but... Anyway, so while this is going on, Bond phones Moneypenny and asks her to check on a name, and that name is?
Well, first, the Pale King.
Yes.
Which she IDs as our old friend Mr. White from the first two movies.
The guy who was Le Chiffre's contact in Casino Royale, and who was apparently working for somebody in Quantum of Solace.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was played by
the actor Jesper Christensen.
Well, he was part of the Quantum board that met at Tusca.
Right. Yeah.
So... But what was the other
name? But he also asks her to investigate a Franz Oberhauser and to find records of him both before and after his death, which confuses her a little bit.
And the audience. But now, while this is all going on, the car chase is taking place.
Which is a great goddamn car chase.
And that's the thing. So I thought this was kind of clever in that you've got what's a very heavy info dumpy scene in a James Bond movie. So they juxtapose that with the car chase. So instead of a briefing or PowerPoint or whatnot, it's Bond's asking this and then careening around some plaza.
Room in the middle of the night.
So you have this car chase taking place along with this who, what, huh, question mark scene, which I thought was kind of a clever way to keep the audience somewhat engaged
and not checking out. If you're really deep into the Ian Fleming books, there was a Hans Oberhauser who was Bond's childhood ski instructor.
And Hans Oberhauser is now, he's now name checked in this film as Bond's guardian and his actual ski instructor.
But in other words, this name has not been mentioned before in this movie. But you might have heard it before if you've paid close attention in the books. But maybe not, because it's like name dropped in one place.
It's pretty deep cuts. So bravo to the Bond team for still going back to Fleming after all this time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and we find out that White was last seen in Austria.
Now, I would have liked a little more exposition there, because he goes from the car chase to apparently Mr. White's house in the mountains in Austria. And it's like, all Penny can tell him is the last time we've got an unconfirmed report he was somewhere in Austria. Or Austria.
Did you serve the entire country of Austria?
So apparently Bond, I don't know, maybe he did search the entire country of Austria, because he apparently goes straight to Mr. White's house.
Right. There's a scene in between, though. Meanwhile, in London, CM and Bill Tanner are attending a conference where the various countries of the world are voting to form the Nine Eyes surveillance program. This is what C is really behind. It is going to give them total surveillance capability, and thus they won't need those assassiny agents in the field anymore. Or so he claims. It fails by one vote. South Africa does not go for it.
Well, apparently the rules are such that everybody has to agree.
It has to be unanimous in this case, yes. Tanner and M start wondering if Bond is actually still in London. So they call up Q, and Q lies that he's in Chelsea, but realizes this isn't going to hold up much longer.
Bond, according to the screen, is clearly in Austria.
You see, well, Tanner gets a newsflash, comes across Tanner's phone, that apparently an expensive Aston Martin has sunk in the River Tiber in Rome.
That's what it is.
And of course, you know, when an Aston Martin sinks somewhere... Well, there's only really...
Are we sure Bond is in London?
Because naturally, the first question in his mind is, and this makes perfect sense, an Aston Martin in a car chase in Rome? Are we sure Bond's in England?
Yeah, you'll notice it's not anybody else. I mean, none of the 00s ever, you know, it's just the first thought is...
And Tanner probably knows that 009 was going to get the DB10, but 009 follows orders. 009 does what he's told. 009 files his taxes and he doesn't drink. 009 gets his paperwork in on time. 009 does not sink Aston Martins in the River Tiber. And 009's probably going to be dead in 6 months. So, but still, he's not going to be the guy that sinks the Aston Martin.
So yes, Bond does go to Austria. He somehow finds Mr. White's actual house. Mr. White is apparently in his computer-laden awesome surveillance basement, which we don't get to actually see much of because awesome Bond tells him to come back out of it.
I like that. Awesome surveillance basement.
White looks like hell and reveals he is dying of thallium poisoning. Someone put thallium in his cell phone.
A lot of that going around. But anyway, he's dying. He's only hanging on just to try to keep an eye on his daughter.
Right. So Bond says he can protect the daughter if White helps him find this guy, the leader of the organization.
Yeah.
Which White, we still don't know the name of the organization, and White does not actually provide the information.
No.
He's not super forthcoming. So now this is the first hint. Is this the first hint we've got of like a serious retcon going on? Because White was the Schieffer's contact in Casino. He was on the board, apparently on some kind of board. Or he was at the meeting for Quantum, although his role in that organization was never explained.
I think he was presumably, everybody at that meeting was essentially voting on whether to go forward with that Tierra del Fuego project. So you're meant to assume he is one of the people in Quantum.
So he was the one with sufficient presence of mind to actually not instantly leave when Bond...
He didn't wig out when Bond came on the line there, showing.
So you could retroactively consider that he was like the supervisor guy from the next step up.
Potentially, or again, he was probably the only one that wasn't rolled up by MI6 after Bond provided all the information in the wake of that.
Right. And of course, he's like, "Well, why should I trust you?" Bond hands him his gun and says, "You know, there you go. That's how you know. That's my word. My gun is my word as an assassin. So I will protect your daughter if you tell me how to find this guy." He still technically doesn't tell him how to find the guy, but he says, you can find my daughter at a clinic in Switzerland.
Austria.
And that the daughter knows about l'Américain.
L'Américain.
Yeah.
L'Américain.
Which is like the American in French. And then he shoots himself.
He says, good luck, Mr. Bond. And then we're done. So Bond picks up his gun, you know, rifles the dead man's pockets like you do, finds a picture of him and a little girl, presumably his daughter, and then he leaves.
Again, having just seen For Your Eyes Only recently, that very much reminded me of the scene where Columbo hands Bond back his gun when he's on the yacht to establish trust there.
Yeah.
Right. Meanwhile,
this film does seem to be name-checking a lot of Roger moments, and God bless them for it.
It's getting ready to check a George Lazenby moment,
in my opinion. Big time, yes.
So yeah, back in the shiny new super surveillance building, M is talking to C, arguing for the continuation of the 00 program, even in this new world of total surveillance. C says he didn't really want to have to do this, but apparently he's been surveilling everyone, so he plays back Bond's conversations with Moneypenny to prove that M can't even control his own agents.
So now M's kind of pissed because, wait a minute, you're surveilling my guys? Which doesn't sit well with him, and it's not gonna sit well with him, so what are you gonna do?
And, of course, Mr. Hinks shows up to kill White, finds out that White's already dead and being eaten by crows.
And notices, oh, look, there's a video camera up there that may have been recording the entire conversation James Bond had with the guy. Which is a little sloppy on Bond's part because he knows there's his awesome surveillance basement and there's a camera, but Bond doesn't seem to pay a lot of attention to the fact that his conversation may have been recorded. A little sloppy on Bond's part.
So, Bond goes to this clinic, which I thought was in Switzerland, but might still be in Austria. Someplace snowy, anyway. Poses as a patient and meets Dr. Madeleine Swann, who is Mr. White's daughter.
Played by the French actress Léa Seydoux, whom we have already covered in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol from a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's right.
She was the assassin that they met in the hotel room in Dubai. And if I didn't say so then, I'm going to say it now. She is the very dictionary definition of sultry.
Woof. That's fair.
So anyway, he meets Madeleine Swann.
Right. Once he reveals that he's not actually there to be a patient and that he witnessed her father's death and is there to try to protect her, she throws him out.
That he may be a slightly creepy, stalky type international assassin dude and is weirding around. You get the hell out of this. You go downstairs, you drink some kind of crappy kale shake, and then you get your ass out of this place.
So he does need to go downstairs, where they appear to have some kind of clinic bar, but apparently they only serve protein shakes.
Proletic enzyme shakes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which Q, who suddenly turns up, orders one for Bond, and is basically like, look, Bond, if you don't come back right now, I'm going to lose my job. Moneypenny's going to lose her job. We're all going to lose our jobs. We looked into this Oberhauser guy. He's dead. He died in an avalanche with his dad. Just come back. You got to start doing this through channels, or I'm telling him.
I have a mortgage and two cats.
So Bond's like, you do one more thing for me. And this is the most scientifically implausible thing in this movie, I think. If you will analyze the octopus ring, and this is still the original one he got from Sciarra, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, if you'll analyze this octopus ring, I'll meet you at your hotel room in an hour. Implied, I'll then go back with you if we haven't found anything.
Now, in between all this, someone has been kidnapping Madeline Swann.
Oh, yes. Well, the guards come to escort Bond out, and he notices that, yes, Mr. Hinks and some other men are kidnapping Swann. She has lowered the curtain on her, because this whole place is, like, made out of glass. So she has lowered the curtain on her little cubicle office upstairs, because Bond was staring at her from the bar. But behind it, you can see shadows kidnapping her. So he easily beats up the two protein shake guards and goes after them.
Surprisingly, the clinic made of glass is still standing when he leaves.
It's true.
Do you think he comes back on vacation a couple years later and destroys it just to tick it off a list?
Maybe so.
It was on my, I'm sorry, fellows. It was on my to-do list to destroy this clinic a couple of years ago. You don't mind, do you? Crash, clatter, clank.
So Hinks and his men are in several, like, vans or...
I think they're Land Rovers or something. Yeah.
Right. Bond showed up in a plane, and he chases them in this plane. But this plane is incredibly fragile compared to their Land Rovers.
Now, they had one shot of that plane approaching the clinic. And other than that, there's no information offered as to where or how Bond may have acquired the plane. Similar to how he found Mr. White in all of Austria, where did he find the plane? Is it enough, narratively speaking, that he found Mr. White? He is, after all, James Bond. Do we need to go through 15 minutes of the mechanics of him finding Mr. White to know that he was able to find Mr. White?
I think what he gets from Mr. White is more important than how he finds Mr. White. So, similarly, there was a plane somewhere in the background. So, obviously, you know, it wouldn't be that hard for Bond to, grab the plane.
Do we need to spend the 5 minutes of screen time explaining how he got the plane?
Of course
is
not.
It enough that he just shows up in a plane?
You show the plane over there, and you trust the audience can put two and two together as long as the plane...
Yeah. There was one shot of the plane approaching the clinic that I noticed.
Yeah, so...
Okay,
so
okay, just checking.
So his plane is not nearly as bulletproof as their vehicles, apparently, but he is still somehow able to drive them off the road and have them blow up one by one.
I think he's accomplished by running the plane into them eventually.
Right. Oh, by the end, the plane does not have any wings, and he's driving it around like a car.
It's a pretty slam-bang action scene. This is one of those scenes I think would have been very... This is a Roger scene, where the plane gets picked apart piece by piece and Bond is driving it through the snow. That's a Roger scene if ever there was one.
And he goes right through a barn, which I think he did on skis in For Your
Eyes Only. Yes, and then slam, bang, Hinks goes flying through the windshield and just sort of, you know, lands in the snow and is knocked unconscious. And
of course not killed because he's an invulnerable henchman.
And Bond drags Madeline Swann out of the car and she screams and yells at him, "Get away from me, you spy stalker murdery freak," or words to that effect.
Points out that they only found her because he found her.
"Has it occurred to you, you dumbass, that they found me through you? That they followed you to get to me?" No.
So meanwhile, because this clinic is on top of a mountain, apparently the only way to get there is on like a ski lift kind of deal. So.
Or an airplane.
Yeah. So Q is riding this ski lift back to his hotel. Guys who are obviously there to beat the crap out of him are also on the lift with him. He puts the ring on the apparently very convenient little scan this for everything plate on his laptop, and somehow, by what appears to be DNA analysis, it pops up all the villains of the previous movies.
That the ring is apparently passed through the hands of Le Chiffre from Casino Royale and Dominic Green from Quantum and Raul Silva from Skyfall.
And Sciarra and Franz Oberhauser.
And Franz Oberhauser, who is supposed to be...
dead.
Dun dun dun.
Yeah, so there's that much DNA on this one, and not James Bond's, strangely, though he's been...
I'm assuming he filters for Bond's DNA.
That's fair.
Actually, I'm assuming just in day-to-day activities, he's always filtering for Bond's DNA.
Well,
you know, I would speculate, depending on what trouble Bond gets into and what duties Q is actually assigned, that Bond's DNA may be, you know, a matter of rolling concern to Q branch.
That's fair.
That there are hotels all across Europe that have to be swept for Bond's DNA.
Right. So, those guys do try to abduct Q, but one of the cars blowing up gives him his, and a passing ski crowd, I believe, gives him a chance to slip away back to his hotel, where Bond and Madeline regroup with him, and Q explains, yeah, there's DNA all over this ring, turns out that dude is alive, and he has something to do with all the villains from the previous movies.
And that's a little sketchy. Even for Q, that's a little sketchy.
That could have been a better way to reveal that, I think.
But here we are. So, Madeline... In that scene, it's like, Q's like, "You're bringing a girl in here, Bond. It's okay, Q. She knows." But Bond, she knows. Okay.
And then she knows everything. In fact, she knows the name of the organization.
Which is?
Spectre.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be too ironic with that. I love this movie. The dun, dun, dun. Sorry about that. I'll try to back off then.
She also mentions that Le Marquin is not a person, but a place. The hotel in Tangier where her parents honeymooned.
Tangier. Didn't they go to Tangier in Rogue Nation?
Tangier's a pretty popular spy place.
Pretty popular spy hangout. It's possible that was Tangier. Anyway, they go and they find the hotel, and it's one of the funniest damn things I've ever seen in a Bond movie. It's the check-in scene, which we always do. Uh-huh. And then Bond tears the room apart. He doesn't find anything but a bottle of old liquor. And he's drinking a little bit, trying to figure out what the hell. We're in this hotel in Tangier, and what the hell are we doing now? And there's a mouse. And he pulls out his wallet, he points it at the mouse. Who are you working for? Who sent you? Which I thought might have been a Danger Mouse reference.
Maybe just Bond is drunk off his ass moment.
Could be that too.
Is he
actually
going to
Is he actually going to shoot the mouse? Everything else Bond has done, love him, leave him, kill him, everything he's done, the one thing Bond would ever do that would lose his sympathy is shooting an innocent mouse.
You know, at this point, how far has Bond fallen here? This is the deadest of all dead ends. And then mouse shows up.
He doesn't even get to sleep with the girl yet. She specifically said, "Do you think I'm going to fall in your arms because of my dead daddy?" And then she goes to bed all alone.
And tells him, "If you touch me, I'll kill you." I mean, you believe her. And then the mouse goes into
a hole in the wall.
As Meister want to do.
And he gets up, he stickers over, he pours a little bit of the liquor down there, and the liquor flows
into
away.
The wall.
Right. Flows into the wall. So then he punches the wall.
Yes.
He punches the wall and rips boards and plaster out of the wall. And lo and behold.
Apparently White had a secret room back there.
Yeah.
With pictures of Madeline all throughout her life. The tape of Vesper Lynn's interrogation, which Bond stares at for a long time and then puts aside.
Stares at in like rigid fury for a couple minutes before putting it aside.
A list of coordinates that apparently goes with a really crappy looking computer that's been trying to track Oberhauser's sat phone.
They find the coordinates.
And Madeline insists on going with him. He says, "No, I like you alive." And she manages to talk him into it, apparently. Oh, we found out when we were in Q's hotel room that there has been a terrorist attack in South Africa, which, remember, is the one country that did
South
not vote.
A terrorist attack in South Africa?
Right.
Right after the critical Nine Eyes vote?
Right.
Huh.
One country that would not join the unanimous vote for the Nine Eyes program that C wants so badly. So, back in London, surprisingly, South Africa has changed its vote. Nine Eyes is a go. C tells him, by the way, also the Home Secretary has decided to shut down the 00 program effective immediately.
So bite me, M. Yeah.
And this. Now there's a train scene.
And now there's the train scene where they're on their way to coordinates in the middle of nowhere in the desert. And they're on the train and Bond's trying to show Madeline how to protect herself and use a firearm. And she says, "I hate guns." And he says, "Come on, I'm trying to protect you." And she picks it up, bam, pops the magazine, pops the one out of the chamber, puts the gun on the table. Okay, fine, you're good. And that was about that.
Explains that the reason she hates guns is that she once had to use her father's gun to shoot a guy that came to kill him.
Yeah. They have a sort of romantic scene on the train where they're having a couple of martinis in their dinner and she's wearing wonderful silver slip and nothing. Not that I noticed. not that I noticed the dress Miss Lea Seydoux was wearing in that scene at all.
Before that, we actually pop back to London again. Q and Moneypenny visit M in a restaurant. I guess M doesn't have his club at the Blades anymore. And they mention, so Bond is apparently heading out to the middle of nowhere in North Africa, but if you look at it really close on the satellite picture, there's this meteor crater that has structures in it. Obviously, he's heading there and we should do something. And M's like, no, anything we talk about, C already knows because he's surveilling everybody. The best thing we can do for Bond is not help him destroy the smart blood records and not talk about this.
So, yeah, that's the best they can do right now. So they're on the train.
Right. Bonding over dinner.
Henchman.
Right, Hinks suddenly appears.
Kicks the drinks over, to paraphrase Jack Burton, slams the back of Bond's favorite head up against the train wall. And then he's fighting Dave Bautista in the middle of this train. And it's like, oh my God, it's still not quite as brutal as the train fight in From Russia with Love.
It's pretty brutal.
But it's a pretty brutal
fight.
They
go through the whole freaking train.
But it's certainly meant to evoke it, though.
Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely.
Mostly Bond getting thrown through walls and doors and things.
It's mostly Drax beating the crap out of James Bond. But no references made to his nipples. And then Madeline puts two in him.
Mm-hmm.
Or puts at least one
still
in
does
him.
Not stop him.
But still doesn't stop him. But it saves Bond from being thrown out of the train at the last possible second, at which point Bond, beer kegs or something?
There's some beer kegs and some rope there. And so
Bond wraps
Bond's already been trying to strangle Hinks with rope, and there are these beer kegs all chained together that have been shooting out the door of the train that Hinks opened up one by one. So Bond realizes if I tie the rope to that, originally Hinks will get dragged out of the train.
And that's exactly what happened.
This happens. Hinks disappears from the movie. Presumably he's dead, but
No, indestructible henchman, remember?
Yeah.
It's just, you wrap it around his neck, he's pulled out of the train, you do not see him die.
That's true.
You don't see his neck break. He just says, ah, shit. And then he goes out the side of the train. That man's not dead.
No, I was just saying that he could totally show up in another movie.
And I want
because
him
we've seen how indestructible he is.
And I want him to, because he's
he
dainty.
He could be the Jaws of this era.
Because he's dainty. He has his little hanky. He daintily wipes Igor off his metal fingernails. I love it. And then Bond and Madeline are dropped off. First they go back to their cabin on the train and snog.
Like, yes.
It's like, I think one of them says, well, what do we do now? And well, have you never seen a Bond movie, Madeline? You're going to go back to his cabin and he's going to snog you.
This happens.
And this happens. This is the thing.
Let off in the middle of the desert. I'm not sure they thought this through because they point out it might be a bit of a wait before our ride gets here. Yeah. But then a 1940s Rolls Royce with a dapper driver picks them up and takes them to the base in the crater. I love that there's a base in a crater. It's like the next best thing to a base in a volcano.
This is a Spectre base in the middle of a meteorite crater in the desert. This is as Bond as it gets, people. Do you want some Bond? Do you want to get your Bond on? This is Bond. It's Bond and the girl, and it's a meteor crater, and it's the desert, and it's a Spectre base, and fucking Blofeld is there.
Right, and they do the
yes!
They do the polite thing. They very politely confiscate Bond's gun with a little silver tray.
Oh, did you notice? Is the holster what I thought it was? How do you say that word? Chamois? Didn't Fleming talk about Bond having a chamois? Chamois holster? It looks soft and brown. It looked soft and brown. And so Bond gives him the gun and the holster. And it's like, go Fleming. And not unlike Dr. No, they are led to their rooms.
Where there are clothes laid out for them. Strangely, creepily, that picture of Mr. White, younger, and little Madeline is there in the room that is designated for her.
As is, in Bond's room, a photo of him and Hans Oberhauser and Franz Oberhauser.
Hmm.
Huh. That's weird. Why would that picture be in this room, do you think? Huh.
Very strange. So, when 4 o'clock, the time for drinks comes, they are led into a big round room.
With a meteorite in the middle of it.
Yeah, where Oberhauser apparently keeps the meteorite that made the crater. He compares it to Spectre, saying that it spent a long time in silence building momentum until it became an unstoppable force. And Bond reminds him, well, it stopped right here.
Stopped here, didn't it? Yeah, it turns out that Oberhauser has like this huge surveillance operation set up here in this base. There's a control room. And there's computer monitors, and there's hench people all over the place, and he runs the whole thing from an iPad.
And thanks to his visionary man, good old C, he will soon have all the Nine Eyes data, and no intelligence agency on Earth will be able to stop them.
And they kind of go through the actual reveal of the plot very quickly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're staging Tarek's attacks to get all the intelligence agencies to work together, and your guy's running it. Whatever. And Bond's almost like a teenager. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's like you're like getting all the intelligence agencies. You're getting all that together. You're like, whatever, dude.
Yeah, he even wonders why Bond is there. He points out the 00s have already been retired and shows them M's retirement speech.
Mm-hmm. Shows them M's retirement speech from inside. And then proceeds to show the surveillance video from inside Mr. White's house as he's getting ready to blow his head off.
Then this is the point where you get to, Bond says, well, you know, it's pretty obvious what's going on here and outlines the villain's plan.
Yeah.
And the villain's like, well, yes, very good. But you never saw us coming. You finally figured that out.
Like,
but
you personally never saw me
coming, even though I was there.
Right. And then he explains all this stuff that you've gone through over the last few years was all me deliberately causing you pain.
Which is a big fat retcon.
Yeah.
Because when they started the Craig movies, they didn't have the rights to Spectre.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So this is the part I think we need to address. Does this work?
There are two ways to look at it. One, Oberhauser / Blofeld is just twisting the knife. He, you know, he's full of crap. And
could be.
And he didn't literally deliberately do all of this.
His organization was involved, but it wasn't necessarily specifically going out of its way to mess with Bond. And he's just using that to taunt Bond. The other option is, yes, indeed, all the previous movies were, which seems kind of implausible.
This guy's a petty little bastard, though. I can totally see him doing
it. I can accept that the operations from the previous three movies all had Spectre ties. I don't think they were deliberately designed to cause Bond pain.
Right.
I think he's probably full of crap there. I think it's like a happy coincidence that they caused Bond pain.
Right.
I don't think he actually set out to do that, but he's telling him that just to twist it in a little bit.
Similarly, I think the mechanics of, even though they weren't set up the way that the first few Connery movies were, I think the idea that all of these have been Spectre all along, that's not bad. And maybe we're not quite ready to talk about that yet, but he's about to announce it. I really wish they hadn't made the Oberhauser connection with Blofeld.
Mm.
I don't think that's necessary. I haven't thought a plot twist like that was necessary since the first Tim Burton Batman movie.
Yeah, which oddly came out 28 years ago yesterday.
Yep.
That's a perfect time to mention that. Actually, I have a difference of opinion.
Oh, okay.
It's not that I think it was necessary, mm-hmm. but let me rephrase that. Mm-hmm. I think it's necessary given the way they reset the series with Casino Royale.
Hmm.
Because pretty much Brosnan's films, Rogers' films, a lot of these movies, I don't want to say they're formulaic, but you come to a Bond film with a certain set of expectations. There'll be a bad guy, there'll be a henchman. There are certain tropes, there are certain themes, there are certain set pieces you expect to see. You come to Bond movies because they are familiar but different. You're going to get the same kind of thrills in a new way. But Casino Royale changes the stakes a little bit. Casino Royale doesn't actually worry about the tropes too much. It just tells its story. So now we're making Bond films where the obligation is to tell you a story with personal stakes, for the lead. They reset the series with Casino Royale. So we can't just have him come in and move through the story unchanged and shoot the bad guy and sleep with a couple of girls and then curtain down. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. They changed the stakes for the movies.
So it's not enough that Spectre is behind all of this and threatens the free world. It has to be personally connected to James Bond.
Because that's how they've reset the series. We're expecting stories that have a serious personal impact on our hero now.
Well, I think even when we get to the point of we're the people that were blackmailing Vesper Lynd would be enough rather than also I'm your foster brother who hates you.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's one thing for Blofeld to personally not like Bond and want to get Bond. Mm. I mean, there's history there. Look at Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Yeah. Look at the opening for Your Eyes Only.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to screw your stuff up personally, Bond, to get at you. I'm going to hurt you. Because you have injured me, I will now injure you 1,000 times more. That's totally fine. Mm. It's taking it to that next level, having him be his foster brother or whatever. That's the part I don't think it adds anything. I think there's sufficient reason for Blofeld to hate Bond and Bond to hate Blofeld back and then want to basically wipe each other out before getting to the whole foster brother angle. I don't think it adds any extra layer to it. I don't think it's a minus really, but I don't think it brings anything extra to the table that the other pieces they put in play don't already do perfectly well. And I agree, you do kind of want that personal connection. I think there's history.
Because of the way they reset the series, they feel the need to make the villain have that personal connection with Bond. Although having Blofeld be his foster brother, more or less, I think I kind of agree with you, too. It works just fine just being Franz Oberhauser. Yeah. Franz Oberhauser doesn't have to be Blofeld. But since Alan Rickman's dead, it may as well be Blofeld.
Apparently, there was some talk that I saw right after the movie came out that it was fairly late that they determined who was going to be the actual master villain, whether it was going to be Oberhauser or C.
Yeah.
So it's possible that Moriarty could have been Blofeld and Oberhauser would have just been someone he was using because of his vendetta against Bond.
That would have been cool. It would have been cool. Both of them. It would have been the guy that played Moriarty also could have been Blofeld. Mm-hmm. No, I would have loved that. That would have been great.
Now Blofeld is generally kind of vaguely foreign, so I guess it works better.
I think Christoph Waltz, if you had to come down to a choice between the two, I think Christoph Waltz makes a better Blofeld.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
He has that kind of cultured menace.
On the other hand, if you can get Christoph Waltz, let's just go ahead and make him fucking Blofeld.
Yeah. I like his Blofeld. I like pretty much everything about the way this works. I just find that extra layer of the phosphor thing just being unnecessary.
Didn't it thrill you to hear the name Blofeld spoken in a movie theater again, unironically?
Blofeld. I don't like the fact that it's now a completely assumed name.
Well, he said it comes from his mother's side of the family,
though. That's true.
Though.
So presumably his mom was a Blofeld.
Or maybe he had an uncle named Ernst and a cousin named Stavro. Well, after Franz Oberhauser supposedly dies, he's got to have a new name, so he may as well just take a name.
But anyway, we find this out in the next scene, where Bond awakens shackled to a creepy chair, as often happens in these movies.
Franz Oberhauser is dressed in a Nehru jacket, and he's not wearing socks, and he has a white cat. Yeah, did the socks thing bother you? The socks thing bothered me a little bit. Of course Blofeld doesn't wear socks. Pretentious ass.
I did not even notice that.
He wasn't wearing socks. He was wearing loafers with no socks.
I did find that was just weird.
Put some damn socks on.
I mean, Bond...
That actually bothered me a little bit. Put some damn socks on.
I mean, there's a suit laid out for Bond. There's a nice dress laid out for Madeline, and he's not wearing socks? I mean, seriously.
Would think that this meeting he would be dressed up, too. That's true.
I mean...
Where Oberhauser explains his earlier cuckoo reference. As we might know, cuckoos put their eggs in other birds' nests, and then the cuckoos hatch first and push the other eggs out so they don't have competition. And this is apparently what Franz Oberhauser thinks that Bond did to him, that essentially Daddy loved you more. After we had to adopt you because your parents were killed in a climb accident.
So Daddy took you in, and he loved you more, and he's not even your son. I'm your son, you asshole.
And so Franz killed Hans... made it look like he was dead, and then he took another name based on presumably his mom's ancestors, and now calls himself Ernst Stavro Blofeld.
Yes! Blofeld.
There's a white classic cat villain.
And it's like Christoph Waltz, and it's Blofeld, and it's 2015, and all is right with the world.
Naturally, we have to have the torture scene. Apparently, this chair is set up to drill needles into your brain in various spots to take away various capacities.
Now, let's pause for a moment. Yeah. This is... not like a medical facility. This is not just something we're having. Apparently, Blofeld's secret base in the crater, he has a brain drill chair.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. This is not like, we just got this unpacked, or this is passing through here for some other thing. This isn't like the laser at the Goldman smelting plant. Right. This is a dedicated
room for the dedicated brain drill chair.
Yes. Yeah. And he's not wearing socks. I mean, this is like creepy on top of creepy. Mm-hmm.
You are not Don Johnson in 1985. put on socks.
So he claims that he's
You know who wears socks? Hans Gruber wore socks. Mm-hmm. You know who else wore socks? Le Chiffre wore socks.
Mm-hmm. You know who wasn't wearing socks?
Who wasn't wearing socks?
Bruce Willis.
Bruce Willis.
Mm, that's fair.
It's interesting. This Blofeld was old enough to have seen Die Hard. Interesting to think that his role model might have been old enough for Hans Gruber to have been his role model.
So Blofeld announces that before he kills Bond, he's going to put a needle in a particular gyrus of his brain that will cause him to lose his ability to recognize faces. So he won't even remember Madeline.
So, and then there's an interruption.
This doesn't actually happen, mind you.
His aim is apparently off. Normal variation, I guess.
Meanwhile, Bond, while all this is going on, has been fiddling with the strap of his watch, which we remember had that loud alarm.
Like, his hands are tied behind the chair so that Blofeld can't see him. He's trying to get the watch off his wrist. And Madeline rushes over to him. She's like all smoochy. It's like, oh, James, I love you. Mm-hmm. But she means it. James, I love you. And he hands her the watch and says, 1 minute. 1 minute. Oh, okay. Because she's familiar with this world. She knows what he's talking about, right?
And then he says, Tempus fugit, quietly enough that Blofeld can't quite hear it. And Blofeld keeps asking, what'd you just say? And he finally says, time does fly.
And Madeline takes the hint, chucks the watch across the dedicated brain drill room, whereupon it explodes.
Right.
Kablemo.
Cat goes flying.
Right.
Blofeld goes flying. We get
the chair luckily releases Bond.
Bond and Madeline take a run for it. They whack a couple of guards, grab a machine gun.
Shoot everyone in sight.
Shoot everyone in sight. Hit, apparently, the self-destruct switch on the gas that powers the...
Apparently, this was made by the same subcontractor that made the hotel in Quantum of Solace.
Exactly.
Because the base just blows up behind them.
So he basically shoots one natural gas pipe, and the whole base goes boom, 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 bluey. But not before he actually gets to the helicopter and they fly away.
Right. But it's not over yet, because he still has to stop.
It's not over yet.
Right. He thinks he's killed Blofeld, but they still have to stop the Nine Eyes thing from going operational, or Spectre can still make use of it. So, back in London, they meet with M at the safe house, Hildebrand Rarities.
Which may be the very last shred of Ian Fleming that has not been put in a film. Mm-hmm. Every villain, every set piece, every trivia, everything. The last thing left is the name of the short story, The Hildebrand Rarities. They actually use the name from the short story, Quantum of Solace. Mm-hmm. They actually put Quantum of Solace in a movie, but you apparently can't go so far. And nobody fucking knew what Quantum of Solace meant. People complain about that now.
It's the smallest possible unit of solace.
I know that, but we are just the slightest touch more literate than the average bear. We're slightly more literate than the average bear. I still hear people bitching about Quantum of Solace. So I can't imagine calling a Bond film The Hildebrand Rarities. Although, wouldn't you have loved to have seen like a Roger Moore James Bond movie in 1987 called The Hildebrand Rarities? I would have. I mean, I would have.
They did one that was all about Fabergé eggs.
Yeah.
So.
True, but they called that one Octopussy.
Yes, they did.
Which I still feel a little bad even saying the name of that in front of my daughter. It's like that's more of a double entendre than I want to speak in front of my kid.
That was spoken on television in the
80s. I know, but I still feel bad about it. But anyway, so, Hildebrand Rarities, which is a shout out to maybe the last tiny little shred of the literary Ian Fleming that hasn't been put on film. Mm-hmm. Is there anything left?
I think there are couple more, maybe, but I'm not sure. Something called Risiko or something like that.
No, Risiko was echoed in For Your Eyes Only.
Oh, okay.
I think there are echoes of Risiko in For Your Eyes Only.
But I don't think the name.
The title. You know, I had to do a fan edit of Roger Moore clips, Risiko, or a fake poster or something. Anyway.
So Bond and M set off to confront C, and Q is going to hack the Nine Eyes system so it doesn't go online. And outside, we discover that Swan is leaving because she can't go back to this life and she doesn't want to ask James to leave it.
Because it's what he is.
So she walks off into the darkened street as though we're never going to see her again.
And Bond stands there in the street kind of gobsmacked because it's like, what? Don't go. Don't go. And this is like maybe the first time in since Vesper for Dan Craig anyway that he stay. Mm-hmm. Please stay. Don't go. Don't go. And it's like, and it actually hurts a little bit to see her go. And it didn't hurt to see Camille go in Quantum of Solace, and there wasn't really anybody he was connected to in Skyfall the same way. But he's like, you know, don't go. But he goes back on mission.
So M and Bond are in one car, and Q and Tanner and Moneypenny are in a second car. Yeah. A bunch of Spectre guys crash the car that Bond and M are in and grab Bond. So M gets into the other car and goes on to continue the mission.
And Bond is taken to...
The old MI6 headquarters.
Right, where he meets...
Blofeld.
Blofeld.
who has apparently lost one eye in the, with the classic scar.
The classic Blofeld scar. And he's actually, I don't know, they were preparing the building for demolition, but yeah. Blofeld has made some special additions.
That's going to blow up
to the MI6 building.
Well, right. There's also, I mean, you know, my first thought was like, oh, look, we're kind of reprising the Joker plot here from Skyfall here. I mean, he's got James Bond spray painted in bright red letters
on the memorial wall.
Then you've got pictures of... You know, you've got callbacks to Lachief and Silva and Vesper.
But not Dominic.
Yeah. Who?
But not Dominic.
Yeah, there's no one.
Yeah, 100%.
Let's see. He took the time to paste little James Bond, like photocopy a bunch of James Bond heads and put them on the targets in the shooting gallery.
And who is there a Spectre intern?
Whose job it is to photocopy pictures to James Bond?
Because Blofeld doesn't go down to the copier in the workroom. Blofeld does not make his own photocopies.
Well, remember, the little factotum that greets them at the crater base is on the helicopter. I assume he was the one doing the spray painting and hanging the pictures all that stuff.
No, that guy's above that. That guy ranks higher.
I think if Blofeld wants that done, your choices are you do that.
There's an intern. I know there's an intern there, some 22-year-old guy. He's just graduated from liberal arts college. He needs some experience to put in his resume. He's working for Spectre for a summer. That's all. It's just a summer thing. He's going to start grad school. He doesn't have the financing. He doesn't have the student aid line, but he's starting grad school in the fall. And it's like there's a European organization, progressive in the leisure industry, works with migrant women. Well, that sounds good on a resume, right? Migrant women in the leisure industry. That you could put that on a resume, right?
Yeah, he's probably in the basement underwater with two bullets in the back of his head.
But that's because he fucked up the photocopies.
Or not. It's Spectre. They're evil.
Nah, point.
Gee, I don't know. Spectre exploit unpaid intern labor? No, they wouldn't do that.
Yes, they would. It's the intern that makes the photocopies and put them up.
Right. So Blofeld has naturally set up a sadistic choice for Bond. He has rigged the building to blow up in 3 minutes, but he also had his men grab Madeline Swan, and she's in the building somewhere. So Bond can either leave, like Blofeld is about to do, and survive, but lose Madeline.
And live with the pain.
Right. Live with the pain. Or he can spend the next 3 minutes fruitlessly searching the entire building for Madeline and blow up with her.
Which means he hasn't watched Bond movies before, because 3 minutes is plenty of time to find Madeline and get out of the building. Yes.
So naturally, Bond starts running through the building and screaming her name. Meanwhile, back in the big giant building of surveillance, C comes into his office talking to somebody on the phone about, no, we don't just want Bond, we have to find M too.
Yeah.
And, well, there's M.
Right there.
In his office, and Q's at a desk in the back, hacking the system, right there.
And what does M say? He says, well, now I guess we know what C stands for.
Wait, happens first. Yeah, so C's talking about how, he made a deal with Spectre because that way he'll be able to protect the world. Something weird like that. Points the gun from his desk at M and says, I guess we now know that M stands for moron. Then he pulls the trigger, it just goes click, and M reveals he has a handful of bullets that he had previously removed from the gun. I guess we know what C stands for. Gives us a second to think of that other thing that C probably stands for, and then says, careless.
Enunciated carefully and clearly, and only the way Ralph Lord Voldemort finds can. Careless. And it's like, and somehow he manages to say the word careless, where it's a greater insult than the other word would be. And then Bond finds Madeline.
Somehow manages to rescue her just in time as the building blows up. They're in a boat. They get away in a boat.
And here's what happens. Bond, and this is kind of like he takes her in his arms. And this is almost like carrying her over the threshold, right? Mm-hmm. There's apparently something down through the core of the building where like floors have collapsed. You can jump straight down the heart of the old MI6 building and land in a net.
Right. Well, the net. Okay. And you see the net overhead. It's
You've seen that under it. A lot of time.
That's actually to catch little pieces of debris that would fall and land in somebody's head. You remember the parking garage downtown with the big spiral thing? That was basically at a certain point, it's nothing but jacks and netting holding that thing up till they renovated it. That's the same thing. So that was right there. Just like the plane, just like the little fleet of Land Rovers escaping the crater base as Bond's flying off.
Which is like Bond's very good at using what's to hand.
Mm-hmm.
So he jumps down through the middle of the building, lands in the net. They get in the boat and they peel out under MI6 just as the building explodes into smithereens.
Oh, yeah. There's a great bit when Blofeld hits the button to start the countdown. There's, big sirens and blaring things, to let people know, hey, the building's about to explode. You might not want to be here. And this goes down about the time they've wrapped up C over at Surveillance Panopticon Central. And they want to know, where's Bond? And Bunny Penny looks across there, sees the rig sirens going off, the red lights. Like, I can hazard a guess.
Yes.
I love the way the people Bond works with know these things. Well, we sink an Aston Martin in the Tiber. Well, do we know Bond's in England? Is the old MI6 building about to explode? I guess he's probably there. He's probably over there right now.
Q manages to hack the system, and M starts to escort C out of the office to go be arrested, and Blofeld's escape helicopter comes by, distracts him long enough that C can start struggling for the gun. They shoot out a wall, they shoot out the ceiling, which is also, again, this building glass. Is also made of glass, apparently. It rains down on them just enough that they all get discombobulated, and C goes windmilling off the building.
Falls to his death.
Yes.
Like that.
Yep.
And that's the end. I like that little sound effect.
Right. So, Bond is apparently not letting Blofeld get away again, so he goes through the magazines of two different guns before he finally manages to get a crippling shot on the helicopter.
And Bond is attempting to shoot down a helicopter with a handgun over the TAMS. And because he's Bond, he shoots that fucker down.
Yes. On the second, unlike the last shot of the second
Let me say that one more time. I shouldn't swear so much. Yeah. We're trying to do a family show here. Okay. And Bond shoots that thing down.
We e-tagged the last one, man.
We should probably do this one, too.
So, Blofeld's helicopter goes down. Blofeld still doesn't die, though he may get the remainder of his classic injuries because he's just sort of dragging himself along the street out of the wreckage. And Bond confronts him in the street with M watching from one side and Madeline watching from the other, kind of the symbols of the two sides of his life, I guess.
Could not be more portentous symbolism if they tried.
Mm-hmm. And he's got the gun on him, and Blofeld's like, well, okay, go ahead, finish it. And he does what Madeline did in the train earlier with the gun. He takes the...
Pops the magazine
out, gets rid of the last bullet in the chamber, and says, out of bullets.
And then chucks the gun in the TAMS and runs off with Madeline.
Yep. While M proceeds to arrest Blofeld under some 2001 act or other.
Yes. So here we are. And Bond goes and gets the Aston Martin. Yeah, his Aston original, Martin.
The DB5 that Q has been rebuilding from just the steering wheel that was left after the last movie.
And drives off with the girl.
Yep. And that's the end of Spectre.
Is it the end of Bond?
Well, no, we should.
Obviously not.
We watch the credits. It says James Bond will return in the credits.
So there you go.
I don't understand how it cannot, even though it just now introduced this whole new element, I don't see how it can't be the end of the Craig Bond without detracting.
That's the question. This is basically, you have everything back under one house. You can have Spectre, you can have Blofeld, you can have all of that, everything you've ever thought of in James Bond movies. They now all have that. They can make another remake of Thunderball if they really wanted to.
If you really want to open that can of worms again, you can.
But they've set it up so perfectly that Bond has now found, just like he did back in Quantum of Solace, he's found someone he's willing to leave this life for.
Right. I don't see where you go with this James Bond with Daniel Craig. As much as I've actually liked his time as James Bond, I think it would do a disservice to the four movies if you do like the whatever the second Bourne movie is and just, you know, have Madeline get whacked in the head and Bond goes back to
I was thinking the Karate Kid or Austin Powers thing where it's just either she dies or breaks up with me before the beginning of the next movie and thus I'm just back. And
that's the thing, Austin Powers was kind of spoofing there.
So let's game this out for a second. Let's say Bond and Madeline, Dan Craig and Lea Seydoux, let's say the Craig Bond and Madeline go off and they get married, they live happily ever after, the end. This is not going to happen because they're never going to stop making Bond movies.
No, but you get a different actor.
But they could make
another... They have established this little thing where they get a different actor.
And they've even started the continuity over again before, they'll do again.
Let's say Craig goes off with Madeline and three options. She stays with him, she dies, or she leaves him. You could do a whole movie where the life won't let Bond alone and she leaves him at the end of that. Or you could do a thing where Bond drives back up to MI6 at the beginning of the next movie saying, I just couldn't live with her and she couldn't live with me and we're back and we just go off after Blofeld again. We could do a thing where we actually try to tell the story of what's it like to be Bond and married. You could actually take this to the next level. Okay, he's Bond. He's got an actual person he loves in his life. Can he still be Bond and love somebody at the same time? Or you could just whack her. But I don't really want... I don't know how you do that without getting his Quantum of Solace again.
Right. This is the thing. I don't think you can't, with this actor, without just retreading one of the previous movies, do that. This is a nice, compact... You have an arc of development of the character from Casino Royale through all the movies to this one.
Yeah.
I think... I mean, as much as I like Dan Craig's Bond, unless they do it like as a prequel or something,
And let's say we are all on board with the Dan Craig Bond here.
Yeah, I
like
him.
Let's reemphasize that. These are great damn movies.
But I think
they
have reached a point they're going to need to cast somebody else. There's no way... I mean, you could probably... you could keep M on his continuity, because I think he has a great one. You could keep on Moneypenny. Keeping on Moneypenny might be extra confusing. But... I think they're going to have to reboot the whole darn thing.
Well, the way they've got M and Tanner and Moneypenny and Q all set up, I think it would be I don't want them to reboot it again.
Yeah, and
it's only been four movies.
Right, and that's kind of a shame because I like their M, I like Moneypenny, I like their Q. I like everything they've done, but we've reached a point with the character's development that I mean, unless they want to do effectively, you know, the ending of Honor, Majesty, Secret Service. I don't know where they go from here.
I mean, Blofeld is still out there. You could have that, but that just seems terrible.
Well, let's look at it this way. Ian Fleming did that. He wrote Casino Royale. He had Bond fall in love, and he had that woman he fell in love with killed in Under Majesty's Secret Service. If we're talking about going back to Fleming, that's exactly what Fleming did to him.
No, that's fair, but that's going to seem like that was kind of the
Those
point
to
Casino.
Those are different women.
Okay. But what I'm saying is that Fleming had him fall in love with Vesper in Casino.
Yeah. And kills Casino her in the dies. Same thing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then years later has Bond fall in love again, with Tracy.
Right.
And then kills her in the same book.
That's fair.
So even as we think that would be horrible to do that to him, his creator did that to him.
No, that's fair. There's precedence for it, but I think the problem is those are also across a couple different movies with different actors.
Yeah.
So I think it would be weird, I think, with this series of movies, since you started with Casino Royale and you started with Vesper.
Yeah.
It would be, I mean, I guess they could go ahead and do On Honor, Your Majesty's Secret Service and...
Well, I've heard it said that if they'd been smart about it, they would have ended on Her Majesty's Secret Service with him just driving away with Tracy. And then you would have started the next movie with Blofeld killing her.
I don't know. I like On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Oh, I do too.
I mean, I think I mean, there's a sense of closure to that. That, I mean, it's not necessarily good closure, but it does. I wouldn't want to open a movie on that one. It would just
The killing the wife at the beginning of the next one just makes it seem we couldn't figure out what to do with her, so we got rid of her.
Yeah, I mean,
which is what I'd be afraid of here.
You see, here's what I want them to do. I really want them to do a movie. What's it like to be Bond and actually have somebody you love? Can you be Bond and still have somebody in your life that you love? Let's do that story, or let's do a story where they're a team. As much as she protests, I don't want to come back to this life, maybe she does. Maybe she can be persuaded to be a part of this world again.
That would be a very different movie.
Yeah, but I don't think that would necessarily be a Bond movie though. I mean, it may not be.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because obviously they've done the thing where they change the Bond actor and keep the whole supporting cast before. But if we're also saying we need this to not be in the Dan Craig continuity because he's clearly retiring, like we have a perfect four movie arc here.
Yeah, and we do, and that's the I would hate to break up the set because
or maybe they don't make another one.
What?
Okay, at some maybe point they're going to make another.
Well, Barbara's off. What I read is that Barbara's off doing. Michael Wilson's in his 70s. Michael's older now, and Barbara's. I think she's been producing some plays. She's got another movie coming out. Actual other movie coming out.
And no one's
apparently in a big hurry. Well, and Craig was so physically exhausted after Spectre that he was like vocal about, God, I don't want to do this again.
Well, no,
so,
that's fair, and I would.
What if this is actually the end?
I see, that just doesn't,
it seems incomprehensible, doesn't it? So what do you just start the next one, Bond number 25, with a new Bond and just don't even talk about it, and we just kind of maybe play to the assumption that it's a different actor with the same code name?
I've never been a huge fan of that. I've never been a huge fan of the James Bond is a code name traded around thing.
I'm not crazy about it either. So, it's a fun game to play, but I wouldn't like it if they actually did that.
I think you'd have to recast and start fresh, but I mean, these are hard ones to follow.
How do you come up with another James Bond movie that resets the status quo without getting rid of... You see, that's the thing about this ending. It's a really daring choice to make, but it paints you into a corner.
Yeah.
A bad corner. So, I don't know.
And that's the thing. If you're going to do that, you want to get at least two more movies the hell out of it. Because this end, I mean, I can't think of a way to wrap the follow that one up.
Yeah.
And I think just killing off Madeline at the opening of the other one and Bond getting revenge again isn't really...
Because that's just... Because they're just doing Quantum again.
Yeah. Right. So...
I mean, there is the fact that, okay, this did seem different, but technically, Bond ends every movie in the arms of a beautiful woman, and then she's never seen again.
Yeah.
Yes, but, it's
different this time, because it's presented to us as a choice between his life as James Bond, killer for MI6, and his life
in some of those cases, I mean, this is not a long-term commitment sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That, I don't think is the, you know, that wasn't the case with Vesper, that wasn't the case here.
So maybe the way they do it is he just drives back up. Like I said, he just drives back up to MI6 at the beginning of the next one, says, didn't work out. Got anything?
That's life. That's realistic. But, oh, wait. This is a James Bond movie.
This isn't realism. We don't watch these
movies.
Right.
I don't want that. I want to basically see tuxedos and sports cars and exploding watches.
Well, yeah, exactly.
If we're continuing on from this... There are a couple of options. I mean, you've said that in this series of movies, it seems like there has to be some kind of personal connection.
Yeah.
So it could be, though, this will cause the same people that hated Skyfall and Spectre to complain it's not a proper James Bond structure again, I guess. But it could be someone going after them.
Mm-hmm. Or
the one thing that could bring Bond out of retirement could be Blofeld breaking out.
Yeah. Well, if
since he's still around.
That's the, if you have gone to the trouble to keep Blofeld alive in this mm-hmm. one, then if you're and you've just gotten Spectre back.
Now, according to
you would want to use that at least one more time.
Interestingly, according to the big Sony email hack, first draft of this script, Blofeld died, and I'm really glad they changed that.
See, you don't bring him back for just one.
That's what I'm saying, and I'm glad they didn't do that. If you've got Blofeld back, you drag that son of a bitch out for a little bit.
Okay, how long did it take to get this? How long did it take to set this deal up? How many people had to literally die?
Yeah. Or maybe there's a version where Madeline has to go away. That you can't be James Bond's wife. That he's pissed off too many people. That too many people want him dead. That the world he lives in is too dangerous. Even when he tries to not be a part of it. That it's just too dangerous for people around him. And she has to go... Maybe he has to call up his friend Felix and she has to go hide somewhere.
Well, that's what they kind of did with Ethan Hunt's marriage in the...
Which is kind of what they did in Mission Impossible, that you can't actually do this. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a way to do this where we get our Bond back and there's kind of a bittersweet parting. I'll always love you, but you have to go be safe. Maybe that's what they do. And I have heard there were rumblings on Jeffrey Wright's Twitter that maybe he was thinking about being back in Saddle as Felix again sometime.
Well, so
for that matter, maybe you make a Felix Leiter movie.
I would watch a Felix Leiter movie.
I would watch the hell out of a Felix Leiter movie. Particularly with Jeffrey Wright. I love Jeffrey Wright as an actor. He's terrific. I would watch the hell out of a Leiter movie. Although, coincidentally, I'm not actually that excited about those Leiter comics. There's a Felix Leiter comic under the Dynamite license.
He was one of my favorite parts of... Well, he's...
Of Casino and Quantum.
Yeah, pretty much all the ones he's been in. I really want him back as...
And he's like the first guy to come back as Leiter, like the next movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Usually, if they need another Leiter, they just go out on the sidewalk. Anybody busy? Yeah, you. Come here. You want to be in a movie today? Yeah, we need a Felix Leiter over here. So, right now, gentle listener, your guess as to what happens next is as good as ours.
Okay. I can't conceive of a world without another Bond movie at some point.
So, let's go on the record. Bond 25, what's it going to be?
I would say they got to do a reboot. You got to restart. You got to recast. Maybe you can carry some folks over if the script can give you, make it clear enough, like they did with the Judi Dench M, but even that would be a risk. Recast, new script, go.
And make it clear that they're breaking the continuity again, yeah, because I don't see how you do, even if it's a different guy, I don't see how you carry on from this point. I don't know.
Stacey, on the record, Bond 25, what happens?
No, I'm agreeing with him. Okay. I think it's pretty much got to be a total reboot. Though we've thought of some ways they could continue the Craig in this conversation.
That gets you maybe one more. You can't keep going to that well, though.
My money is Dan Craig comes back for one more.
Okay.
They back Fort Knox up to his house in a truck, and he comes back for one more.
And if he comes back, it's only going to be for one more, I'm pretty sure.
His contract's actually up. It would just be the one more. But I think there's enough of a groundswell out there. I think the populace wants him back for just one more. But we'll see.
That's the thing, though. That's going to be, a big truck of money. I mean, it's not unheard of. I mean, look at the third Batman movie.
Oh, yeah. Or how much they keep paying Johnny Depp for crappy pirate movies. So I bet you they come back one more with Dan Craig. That's my money.
The big question is, should they? But that's, I guess, that would depend on what movie gets made.
So we'll see whether it should have been done after it's actually been done. So we are all tremendously thumbs up on Spectre around here. It's been a good 18 months since we saw it. We've come back to it. We've analyzed it in the context of the other films, and we're all thumbs. Oh, wait a minute. Is it believable that Silva was an operative for Spectre?
Yeah, I can buy that.
I feel like we need to check those off a little. We need to check the continuity bubbles off. So Silva presents himself as being freelance, right?
And he's after a very, very personal goal.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he could have gotten some of his money. I mean, Spectre funds all sorts of things.
You can think of Spectre as a evil venture capital outfit. So, I mean, was he officially like Hail Spectre of his own little ring? No, probably not. Was he possibly a useful loose cannon you could point at something? Yeah, totally. I could totally buy that.
Oh yeah, totally. Me too.
I like Scaramanga. He's a freelancer. Yeah. He screws up whoever you pay him enough to screw up.
So Le Chiffre, banker to the world's terrorists, was he simply just handling money for Spectre?
Well, we knew he was working for somebody higher.
Yeah,
Quantum was basically meant to be the replacement for Spectre in this continuity of movies.
So that's the part I feel like we got to address here. Is Quantum a part of Spectre?
Yeah.
Is Quantum another organization altogether? Was Quantum just the name for that operation?
I think the easiest way to slot it in and reconcile them is Quantum was some compartmentalized subset of Spectre. Le Chiffre was working for Quantum. Whether he knew it by the name Quantum or not isn't really relevant. Then, that rolls up to Mr. White. Okay, fine. Mr. White rolls up to Quantum. Quantum rolls up to Spectre. Now, okay, maybe Quantum was basically compartmentalized. It didn't know the larger Spectre organization existed.
That's kind of what I think.
Then White is the connection between Quantum and Spectre. He's the Spectre rep on the board, whether they know it or not.
So I think Green probably knew.
I mean, Green and the other Quantum board knew White. Now, whether they were totally read onto Spectre or not, not strictly speaking, relevant, really.
But it's possible to look at this, even though it's a retcon, we go from Shifra to Quantum, and then Silva's an operative, and then it all goes back to the octopus. All tentacles of the octopus.
Silva's the one you have to do a little bit work for, because he seems to be kind of self-directed, self-funded, and they had decided to move away from Quantum for that one, it looked like. Quantum just being the large organization that was supposed to be a Spectre stand-in, being a subset of Spectre once you got it back. Yeah. That's an easy add, no problem. You're just adding one more layer to the conspiracy. Silva takes a little more work, but I think you can totally make it fly,
Now, I do want one more movie where they develop Spectre and Blofeld in this version of it. I really honestly want one more where they keep this storyline going.
Right. Yeah. That's my biggest regret, and I'm not 100% clear on why they decided to make this such a perfect bookend, except maybe they thought Dan wasn't coming back. But
Or just to do the surprising choice.
Yeah, that's true. But you finally can use Spectre again. You do keep Blofeld alive throughout the movie. I mean, Spectre's an ongoing threat. It's not just one thing. They even pointed out in this movie when they thought Blofeld was dead, well, Spectre's still out there.
Yeah.
They can replace number one as easily as anybody else.
Well, the thing about these, unlike you, we live in an age of franchises.
Yeah.
There's apparently, I'm told there's a new Transformers movie out.
Really?
Yeah.
Hadn't noticed. I'm trying not to notice.
You were the one making noises about going to see it.
Yeah. I don't remember that.
You read the reviews.
Okay. I have no idea what you're talking about. I just said no such thing.
Okay, so there's a new Transformers movie out, I'm told. And it's terrible. I don't have to be told this. I can probably just guess it. So, you look at The Hobbit. One book got turned into...
Oh, God.
Three movies, arguably with two movies worth of material. And that's...
In that stretch.
I think you could probably... You can make a cut out of the last two movies that pretty much was be a serviceable movie. There's a lot of padding. There's an awful lot of padding.
The third movie
is fighting, is the Battle of Five Fighting Armies that fight some more.
You probably could have made one good movie.
The first one I think is pretty strong, Samson. I don't think you could make, you would have had to cut something. I think the first one is just about perfect.
Yeah.
I think it's the second, they went to try to pad it out and make the second movie into two movies is where it goes off the rails.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we live in an age of franchises.
Yeah.
So the studios, they want more stuff.
Your moviegoing experience is these days dominated by, to the joy of many, the lamentation of many others, the moviegoing experience is dominated by the big tentpole movie. The big $200 million budget, advertising, merchandising, tie-in, swing for the fences. I hear people whining and crying around all the time that you can't get a middle budget made anymore. You have your $5 million horror movie and you have your $200 million Marvel movie and there isn't anything in theatrical in between anymore. It just won't make any money. This is the state of things. And I hear people lamenting that all the damn time. My ongoing philosophy of film is I don't like paying ticket price for a movie that's more or less the same as eavesdropping on a conversation at Hardee's. This is my stated philosophy. This is my religion here. I don't want to pay $10 to see actors acting about a conversation that's more or less what you get eavesdropping at a fast food place. I stand by that. But then again, Guillermo del Toro says that everything is cinema now. Everything on TV is cinema. You don't get a lot of just standalone episodes anymore. Even a lot of your situation comedies have ongoing storylines and plot arcs. And everything on Netflix and everything streaming is a 10-part series with a big epic storyline. I don't mind the theatrical experience being reserved for big, giant, explodey movies. If I want to watch a small story about a family in crisis, there's shit tons of that on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or Network or whatever you want. I do feel like a lot of that complaining, you can't get like a middle budget movie made anymore. Well, maybe you've been making really boring middle budget movies for a long while now.
You can get... Well, okay, what counts as middle budget kind of keeps shifting as the high end goes up.
Fair point.
I think you still can get some... I mean, there are plenty of actors that make... Well, not plenty. There are some that are famous for coming in under budget. The guy who did Godzilla, and look at the work on District 9 and Elysium, I think.
Blomkamp,
Those were really well made, and they made them on a fractional budget of what a larger Hollywood operation would have been made on. Now, interestingly, you look at District 9, you look at Elysium, they aren't really sequels or really related in any way, but you can kind of see...
But the aesthetics are similar enough that you can kind of see them as connected in a way. You're right, we do live in this world of the big tentpole franchise movie. And I kind of like it this way.
Well, the thing is about franchise, though, and that's the thing, like, okay, we're going to make Transformers 5, which is basically just as dumb as Transformers 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah.
Because that's the easy, safe, predictable route.
Yeah.
And why do we get so many reboots and remakes? And, okay, we're going to make a comedy version of this 90s TV show.
Yeah.
Okay. Or look at, we're going to bring Power Rangers back, which was surprisingly good.
Actually a really good movie.
But, so...
God forgive me for saying it. It was a really good movie.
No, it was a good movie. A good movie... I was not a Power Rangers fan. I never really watched the show. We went like, okay, we're going to see it's going to have big robot fighting big monster. Okay, I should go see this. And The Breakfast Club meets Power Rangers was kind of cool. But that's the thing. I think going back to this age of franchise idea, okay, here we have the possibly the biggest franchise. It's this and Godzilla in terms of the biggest franchise ever. And they pretty much made, okay, boom, we've just bookended this. We've just made a Bond movie that's really, really hard to follow.
Yeah.
And they could have just left it open-ended. They could have just had her get killed at the end. They could have just had Bond just shoot Blofeld in the head and make a different choice there. And that would have been just in keeping with the character. But they didn't. They continued that development of the character we've had over these four movies. And now it's somebody else's headache to figure out how the heck do you follow that? Yeah. And, you know...
Well, no, it's not. It's their headache.
Well...
It's Barbara and Michael's headache to figure out how do we follow
well,
this
Well, there's up. some other script writer, but yeah.
Well, actually, they've apparently hired the same guys they've been using since Brosnan, Neil Purvis and Robert Wade. Robert Wade, it's the same guys they always... Right.
But I guess that's
according to the trades, they hired them to bang out a treatment a couple of months ago.
All right, so, I mean, they made a movie that could very well, you know, I'm not sure you could get... You're going to have to basically do another reboot. You can't keep making more Dan Craig Bond movies. Yeah. And this kind of...
Or you could... But your fear is that if they tried to make another Dan Craig Bond movie after this, it would really rip up the great emotional satisfaction at the end of this movie.
I don't think you can take that. And the thing is, it would have been really easy to take the other route to give you that opening for a fifth one and leave it ambiguous.
But they didn't.
Because if you look at the last three, if you look at, well, obviously Casino Royale, you look at Quantum, you look at Skyfall, it's those end, you can go on more James Bond movies forever and ever. I mean, we were talking about the end of Skyfall. You've got M and Moneypenny and Q and the office with the leather door.
Perfect.
You know, and you could keep making 1,000 James Bond movies off of that. They made the last James Bond movie is the next one. In the age of franchise, that's kind of a brave choice.
It's a ballsy choice to have ended this movie the way they did. I don't think for a second, you know, come to think of it, I really don't think for a second that Barbara and Michael don't end this movie the way they end it without having some idea what to do next.
One would hope. One would assume. I mean, they've been making these a while. I would not bet against that proposition.
Cubby would not have ended this movie this way. Cubby wouldn't have done this.
He would have just left it open.
He would have left it open. Oh. He would have done the thing where he would have done a more traditional ending. Where technically you're right. Like the sequence of events: bad guys captured, Bond drives away with the girl. This is how they all end. It's the emotional subtext to this Cubby would have never signed off on. And I think Barbara is a lot. I am going to say it. I think she's braver than her father. Hmm. I think she made a much braver decision than her father would have made in this movie. And I don't think she would have made it without having some idea of what she wanted to happen next. I don't think. I'd be surprised. I'd be surprised if she or Michael Wilson, either one, would end the movie the way they ended it without having some idea what they wanted next.
I mean, I guess you could...
And that could be the reboot. That could be some way to dig your way out of this story. It could be a very blithe, oh, well, like the beginning of Austin Power 2's. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, oh, babes.
Goodness, I hope that wasn't...
I really hope it's not. That's not the plan.
We all love... I presume Star Trek 3, even though it pretty much undoes the huge emotional thing of Star Trek 2.
Yeah, but also still manages to be very emotionally satisfying as well.
Fair. I like 3. I mean, 2 was pretty much either going to be the last... I mean, 2 was on track to be the last Star Trek movie. Because Motion Picture was a complete fiasco.
I won't say it was a complete fiasco. It made all its money back.
It was a very, very hard movie to make. Yeah, they ran into all kinds of problems, over budget, over...
I know.
Some of the effects didn't get finished until the director's cut, 20 years later?
As I recall, the print they put in the projector the night of the premiere was literally wet from the processing.
Yeah. Mm. It was...
It was the last possible moment.
Yeah.
And then Star Trek 2 was a much smoother experience, made everybody happy. Even Leonard, who swore he wasn't coming back again, kind of... I know I'm messing up the anecdote, but more or less at the end of Star Trek 2, kind of goes up to Harv Bennett and says, I kind of had a pretty good time making a Star Trek movie. You know, I know there's that part where you said you were going to kill me off, but I was wondering if, you know, maybe we'll do another Star Trek movie sometime. You know, kind of like that. I imagine Leonard kind of moving his head around, rolling his eyes, kind of digging his toes in the dirt. You think, Harv, we could make another Star Trek movie sometime or something?
We literally just spent an entire movie dramatically killing you off, Leonard.
And I'm,
yeah, I know.
And the thing about that, I like Star Trek 3, and I like some of the stuff they do in there. I really miss the David character, and I really miss the whole... And you arguably make the case, you know, that Leonard coming back, pretty much, they're going to have to shoot Savick or David one in the head, and they... I would have been curious what sort of Star Trek we would have gotten if Leonard had decided not to come back.
If they were moving toward a literal next generation at one point, it seemed like.
I am quite happy with the way things played out. I love Star Trek's... I love all six of the original cast movies, honestly. But I do agree with you. There's a part of me that would like it to have continued on the way 2 was implying, that we're getting older, we're having younger characters come in. What does a Star Trek 5 or 6 look like with David Marcus and Savick, and maybe we start replacing the other characters too?
Yeah, well, I think I'm
kind of sad they didn't do that.
They killed Scotty's obvious replacement in the middle of the movie, so you can't have him too. But
I do agree with you about that. I wish they had
I would have been
played that storyline out a little bit.
You know, and again, I'm from the Vonda McIntyre novels.
Yeah.
Which were just really good.
And in the case of Star
really
Trek,
built up those characters.
In the case of Star Trek too, taking a really superior screenplay and building it out in some really interesting ways.
Yes. Yeah, so when I would have been like third or fourth grade when that came out. I mean, I just kind of assumed, oh, well, this is the novel. This was like the full, you know, the people writing the novel must have the full script and they must have cut stuff out for the movie because this whole bit under the tree. I wish they would have filmed that scene. Mm-hmm. Not knowing that, okay, they probably here's the script, and then okay, Vonda, here you got to hit these points, and
she added stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, fourth grade.
Usually they do have a different version of the script that they do the novelization from, but then they also add a whole bunch of backgrounds.
Well, and that's the thing. Sometimes you can get, I guess it depends on when the script is released.
Paging Ellen Dean Foster.
Yep. Yeah, I get the impression for some movies the pace of rewrites and studio-driven changes is a lot faster. I guess that's the one thing with the, you know, with the advent of digital and such, the dailies, which is like everything else in modern communication, the ability of people two or three levels up in the chain of management to mess with things has also been accelerated.
The one I always remember as just being bizarre was the Dick Tracy novelization of the Warren Beatty movie where Max Allen Collins, I think, was not allowed to reveal the twist. So he just had to, like, say, and the blank turned out to be the person who was the blank.
Oh, you're kidding.
Weird.
That's weird. Oh, that's so stupid. Mm-hmm.
Movies,
kids!
Tracy gasped in horror as he saw the face. It's you! Yes, Tracy, it's me!
Yeah, pretty much like that.
Oh, that's horrible.
That's really awful.
Did they just... Instantly,
why in the hell was there never any more Dick Tracy?
I think we have Warren Beatty to blame.
That's
for
probably
that.
It, yeah.
Probably.
I'm asking rhetorically more than anything else. Warren's just been sitting on the rights for the last 27 years.
You would think.
But it's okay. He's old. He's probably going to die soon. And maybe we'll finally get some
I
more Dick
I wonder
Tracy.
If we're going to hit that point. I'm not one of these people that says, okay, hey, oh, you know, just can these superhero movies, can we be done with the superhero movies yet? You know, there's people that just are annoyed at superhero movies, not quite noticing that. If you look at the Marvel movies, they've been, 15, 16 different movies that happen to have superheroes in them, but they're all different movies. Yeah. Right. They're different kinds of movies, different genres
of movies. There's a website I look at, Deadline.com, and every time anybody says anything about a superhero movie ever, there's always a bunch of bozos in the comments, oh, God, can we just be done with the superhero movies already? Well, no. No, we can't, because there are those of us who really enjoy that kind of material. And we're going to go see them. And we're going to go see them until they stop making them. And you can, shut your cake hole.
Hey, can we be done with very nicely framed and shot movies about boring people talking about boring things and emotionally deep emotional traumas and whatnot that are very well made and very well written and very well acted, but are in no form or fashion remotely entertaining to watch? Maybe?
Paging Casey Affleck.
There are tons of...
What was that movie he was in... what was that Oscar bait he was in where like his brother dies, he's got to take in his brother's kid, but he doesn't want his
Manchester
brother's
Manchester
kid.
By the Sea.
Yes. Oh my holy Christ. Who in the hell would pay money to watch that? You see, that's what I'm saying. It's utterly mystifying to me. I don't understand why people watch that movie. I really don't.
Well, okay. The thing is, it's probably a very good movie. It's probably very well written. It's just not what I'm going to pay at this point, $10-$12 for a ticket to go
now,
see.
Now, okay. I know intellectually that we have to portray That maybe why you go see that movie is because you see people coping with emotionally difficult situations, and by watching drama about these situations, it reaffirms something about our common humanity to see the struggles we all go through, to see recognizable human struggles on the screen. And I understand all that intellectually, but I reassert my core principle that I can get basically that experience by eavesdropping at people at Hardee's. And I don't want to pay $12 to go see that on a big screen. I just don't. I'm sorry.
I mean, this thing's like, do I want to sit down and watch Old Yeller again?
No, you don't.
No, I do not. Full stop. Okay, Chasing Amy. Am I glad I saw Chasing Amy? Yes. Am I ever going to sit through that again? No, because
but
I don't want to...
But you will sit through Jay and Silent Bob again someday, won't you?
Maybe.
Or Clerks, or maybe Mallrats, but not Amy.
No. Because again, it's not a bad movie. It's a great movie.
Mrs. Number 6 really loves Dogma still.
But it's like getting punched in the groin. I got punched in the groin once. I mean, weirdly, I just think about this. I really like Civil War. I haven't gone to see Civil War a second time. I saw all the other Cat movies 2, 3, 4 times, I think, you know.
So
I saw Force Awakens 5 times
and counting.
Yeah. So
you could go upstairs right now, bring Civil War up Netflix, watch it 2-3 times in a row if you wanted to, but you're not going to do it.
I'm going to eventually. I'm probably before the next Avengers movie comes out, I'm going to watch it. But That one was a little rougher than what we were expecting going in. It was great. I'm glad I watched it. I don't regret a second of it.
No, but... I think their emphasis is that that it'll be so satisfying to see the Avengers come back together after being torn so thoroughly apart.
And again, the punch in the groin from Civil War was not the same level, say, chasing Amy.
Or actually being punched in the groin.
Yeah, that's fair. I am not sure where we were going with all of this.
We were talking about franchise movies, and it's insane to think that they're going to stop making Bond films.
Yes.
But they seem to have painted themselves into a corner with this one, and it's going to be really interesting for us as film fans and Bond fans to see what they do. So have we chewed this subject up enough? I think so.
I think, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot going on in this one. It's a great movie. If this was going to be the last James Bond movie ever, it's not a bad one to go out on.
We don't actually think that's going to happen.
No, but I mean, but that's the thing though. If you're going to make a movie and, you know, and look at Star Trek II, that could have easily been the last Star Trek movie. And it would not have been a bad Star Trek movie.
No, not at all.
It would have not been a bad way to say farewell to those characters. Mm. Take a movie like Serenity, which didn't get any sequels. That was a pretty good ending to Firefly.
Yeah.
I mean, there could have been a lot worse ways for it to end. Say, I don't know, getting canceled with 3 episodes unaired.
Do you think if maybe Joss had held back his bloodthirsty instincts and maybe left Wash alive, more of us would have gone back to see it twice?
I went to see it like 3 or 4 times.
Would you have gone to see it 8 if Wash was alive?
That's the thing, though. When Wash bites it, at that point, you are fully invested in who's going to live and who's going to die. Because there is no guarantee anybody's going to walk away at that point.
Honest to God, I think we would be on Serenity 2 or 3 now if maybe the core Firefly fan base had felt a little warmer and happier coming out of the movie. I respect that Mr. Whedon felt the need to stick to his artistic integrity, but I think we would have all been a lot happier with maybe less dead big damn heroes at the end of the day.
Look at Star Trek 2. Mm-hmm. You walked out of Star Trek 2.
They only killed one guy. They killed Spock. They didn't kill Spock and Scotty. They just killed Spock.
There are...
Oh my God, he killed Shepard. Oh my God, he killed the shepherd. Oh my God, Mal's going to kick his ass now. Oh my God, he stabbed Wash. Oh, Jesus, Lord. Too far.
Right, but at that point, you weren't sure who was getting out of live at that point.
I'm not saying it didn't make for a better movie.
It made for a great movie.
But what it doesn't make for is Serenity 2.
I think the number of tickets... The fact that we got that one at all...
is still kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, there was never going to be a Serenity 2.
It was a niche show. It punched above its weight. They got the movie made. You can't take any... I'm not trying to take anything away from that.
Oh, God, no.
I don't think we were going to get a second or third. And I think...
Never, ever.
I think everybody involved kind of probably knew that. It would have been awesome... But they did so much better than any other show in their shoes ever had a chance. Yeah. I mean, it was, in a sense, I mean, it's probably, it's better to go out at that point. It's better to go out on a high note like that than it would be to try to follow that. And how the hell would you follow that?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I got to agree with Ray that the whole deal is, I don't like that Wash got killed. But yeah, at that moment, it was perfect because you're like, oh yeah, they may only have one movie. I have no idea if any of these characters are actually going to survive this. It appears that they put themselves in an unsurvivable situation.
So you guys are voting for artistic integrity over coddling the fan base in the vague long shot of a sequel.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, you're probably right.
Make a good movie. Make the best movie you can possibly make if you...
Leave it all on the field.
Yeah, I mean, because you may not get another one. I mean, again, go back to the quote you referenced a long time ago about the producer that stood up and clapped at every single movie. Doesn't matter how bad it was. Because...
what it took to get it made.
Yeah, all the stuff, it's a miracle they get made. It's a miracle that anything from that script makes it onto the screen in the first place.
Every single time.
So if you are there, if you are filming it, if lights, actions, and camera, film is rolling, there's a craft table over there. Make the best possible movie you can make. Leave it all on the field. Don't hold anything back.
Fair enough. All right, Spectre. Thumbs up all around.
Yeah.
Where we are waiting with bated breath to find out what possible directions the next Bond film takes. And as soon as it does, you come right here and we'll break it all down for you. Thank you so much for listening. Yeah, thank you so much for listening. We love doing this. Thank you for listening to us. Ray, if you would, email address.
Ray@agentsof.cool.
Stacy.
Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, no period, at agentsof.cool.
Number 6, all lowercase letters, at agentsof.cool. Please send us your emails. Let us know your opinions. We will read any email. I'll go ahead and tell you straight. We'll read your emails on the air. We desperately want to do that. Email us. We will read your emails on the air. If there are specific topics you want us to address, we'll take that under consideration. Again, thank you so much for listening. And as always, the Agents of Cool will return. Welcome to the Agents of Cool.
You said you wanted reverb.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
That was amazing.
I
love that. That was amazing. We need to do that more often.